From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. The federal government is fully reopened, at least for now. Yesterday, the House voted 217 to 214 to fund most government offices through September. Congress now has fewer than 2 weeks to negotiate the Department of Homeland Security budget. At issue is Immigration and Customs Enforcement's handling of the Trump administration's deportation efforts, especially after the death of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minnesota in January. Those deaths have sparked a national debate over ICE's use of force. That includes protests here in Nevada. KNPR recently went to a demonstration in Las Vegas and spoke with some of the participants about their concerns.
Immigrants are welcome here.
No fear, no hate, no ICE in our state.
No fear, no hate, no ICE in our state.
No fear.
ICE agents are killing people in the street. That's scary.
No fear,
that's legitimate.
No hate,
so it's more
no
a war
ICE
on not following the fascist regime that Donald Trump is placing on everyone right now, and we still have our First Amendment right, and we should use it.
I will admit that I am a bit scared. I'm concerned for the future, my family and loved ones, but I think it's important to not let that deter you. Fear is a weapon that the ruling class likes to use against people. They want you to see the killings, they want you to see the violence, and they want you to stand back in line. But together, we are way more stronger than alone.
I'm feeling concerned. I feel that this is not a time to be quiet. I think that this is a time to be seen and to let our voices be heard and protect our rights. The same right that lets me wear this collar is the right that should be protecting the citizens in Minneapolis and are not currently.
That was Jordan Moore, Matthew Becerra, and Reverend Andy S. of Las Vegas speaking to KNPR after the death of Alex Preddy late last month. Northern Nevada's Republican Congressman Mark Amadei also recently weighed in on the matter. He serves as the chair of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Homeland Security and helped negotiate federal funding for ICE. He recently spoke to Nevada newsmakers about the recent events in Minneapolis. Here's what he had to say.
What you're doing now isn't working. There needs to be a pivot.
Not a go away, whatever. It's like, listen, you told people, I'm talking about the administration, you said, worst first, people who've had their hearings, that's the general mission. And so, if that's what you're doing, and I should be able to tell you whether they are or not, and I can't tell you. And the guy from the Border Patrol who's in charge of the overall operation doesn't report to the commissioner of the Border Patrol.
That's Bovino, right?
Yeah. Doesn't report to the commissioner. He reports directly to the Secretary of Homeland Security. That setup, you know... The good news is you want control, you got it. The bad news is when control's not a great thing to have, you got that too. And so there needs to be a pivot in the culture. The mission is good. The culture for how you're enforcing that, I'm looking forward to hearing what Tom Homan has to say. But we're not waiting for it. We're in the process right now of saying this does not inspire confidence in the decisions made at the department level. That's as nice as I can say it.
Of course, Democrats have had a lot to say in recent weeks. That includes Nevada's junior Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen. Rosen has co-sponsored a bill with Nevada's senior Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto that would strip ICE of billions of dollars in funding and instead use it for local law enforcement. She's also calling for Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem's impeachment and an investigation into White House Border Czar Tom Homan for allegedly taking a $50,000 bribe for helping to secure favorable government contracts. I spoke with her about her concerns and what she'd like to see come out of this latest round of DHS funding negotiations. Senator Rosen, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here with you today. Thank you.
You're among the growing number of Democrats who have voiced strong opposition to federal immigration efforts in recent weeks. However, that issue is just coming to a head after two people died in Minnesota. When did you first become concerned?
Well, I've been concerned all along with Trump's cruel and chaotic cabinet. The people that he has put in charge, particularly of Homeland Security, you have Kristi Noem, Bovino, you have Homan, people who are thriving in their cruelty, people who are, as leadership, letting their boys run wild, telling them that they are above the law, that they have no rules, putting quotas on people like they're in a way that just makes absolute no sense. They're telling their employees that they are above the law, well, I want to give him a clue. No one is above the law, and we need to hold all of our law enforcement accountable. We need to hold them to standards. And we see that with our state and local law enforcement. We need to hold them to training standards, accountability, and transparency. And Kristi Noem, Tom Holman, and everyone else, what they are doing, the leadership is rotten from the top. This is why we're calling for Kristi Noem's impeachment. And of course, there's so many others, but the leadership at the top is creating a pervasive, allowing a permission set at ICE for them to run rampant through our streets, and we can't stand for it.
Let's talk about this government shutdown. The House just voted to fully reopen the government. However, that funding package contains just enough money to keep the Department of Homeland Security running for the next 2 weeks. What would you like to see come out of those negotiations?
Well, what we're asking for is reasonable reforms and guardrails on ICE and CBP. So what do we mean? We want ICE and CBP to be held to the same standards that we hold our state and local police departments, a uniform code of conduct that governs federal law enforcement use of force. We want to require cameras to be used by ICE and CBP officers. We want to end those roving patrols. It's absolutely ridiculous. They're stopping cars on the street, pulling people out, leaving the cars running. Children are in the car, people's belongings, their pets. And then they just abandon the car, which is a public safety hazard. And number one, we want to ban the use of masks by ICE agents conducting immigration enforcement. We want to require them to wear identification. We want to require them to be in marked cars. And we want to require them to have uniforms and the proper damn training, because every police officer I talk to is the number one thing they're trained in a situation is de-escalation. And so it's for the safety of the officers and the safety for everyone involved.
Do you think ICE should be abolished entirely?
I think that this is the leadership at ICE is what is the problem. ICE has been around for 25 years, and we have not had these kinds of issues. Have we had these roving patrols before? Gangs of people who are masked and unmarked vehicles just running up and shooting people in the face, taking pepper spray and putting it straight in the eyes and the nose and the ears of individuals. Have we ever seen this behavior before in 25 years? No. And so we need to be sure that they are held to the same standards as we expect everyone else. The laws are not suggestions, and our law enforcement needs to and must be held accountable. And so it is the leadership that is letting them run wild. We need to be sure that we invest in our state and local police departments so that they can have proper mental health services, that they have the proper tools, technology, and resources for them to do their job, that they have the wraparound services so that when they go to a call, they have places where if someone, it's domestic violence, where they can take people, if there's drug issues, if there's other kinds of issues, where they can work with community services in order to take care of the public so they can do community policing, after school programs. These are the kinds of things in our community that keep us safe. That's what I want to invest in.
It's clear the Trump administration plans to continue its deportation efforts. Are you concerned at all that despite the negotiations that the administration will just ignore Congress?
Well, just because the administration decides to disregard the rules or disregard Congress or think that laws are just suggestions does not absolve me of my responsibility to create laws and try to enforce the law. It would be the same thing as saying everyone's going to run the stop sign, so why should I put up stop signs? We are going to create the laws, try to enforce the laws, and again, hold people accountable in any way that we can when they violate those laws. So whether they choose to ignore it or not does not relieve me of my duty to be sure that the laws on the books are to require people, and particularly our law enforcement in this case, to be trained, responsible, transparent, and treat people with dignity.
What are you hearing from your Republican colleagues on all of this? Are they voicing concerns?
I can tell you that our Republican colleagues behind the scenes are voicing concerns. And what they need to do now is to stand up for those reasonable reforms and guardrails, the same ones, again, that their local and state police, county police do all across this country, a highway patrol, state troopers, you name it. And so they need to come out from behind the shadows quit being so damn afraid of Donald Trump and what he might do to them and stand up for their communities, because people are being rounded up. They're going into grocery stores, Targets, Walmarts, you name it. They're going everywhere and anywhere they can to create the most terror and fear that they possibly can. And this has to stop.
You're also, as you mentioned, calling on your colleagues in the House to start impeachment proceedings against Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem. If she's replaced, do you think things will get better at ICE or within Homeland Security?
Well, I can tell you right now, she is part of the problem, and she is the one that is instituting these policies. Now, the president, we know, has a cruel and chaotic way about him, and he has a cruelest of cabinets. So I don't know who will be replaced by her, but that doesn't, again, prevent me from trying to hold her accountable for how she's leading this agency. And she is leading this agency down the wrong path. It is a path of lawlessness. And so the Senate will have to confirm any new appointee. And we have that oversight. And I want someone, again, who will run a law enforcement agency in the proper way. And again, we've had Department of Homeland Security for about 25 years or so now. We haven't seen this kind of issues in this way. It doesn't mean that they couldn't be better always, but that is our job to be sure that we hold them accountable. And we're going to continue to do that with our oversight ability.
Senator Rosen, thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate you. Thank you for having me.
It's early February across much of Nevada, but it feels like early spring. In Las Vegas this week, temperatures are in the low 70s, and while there's still plenty of time for winter to reassert itself, there's also a lot you can be doing in your yard or garden right now to prepare for the warmer months. So we thought it was time to check in with KNPR's resident horticulturalist, Norm Schilling, to learn more about what we should and shouldn't be doing in the garden this time of year. Norm is the owner of Mojave Bloom Nursery and Schilling Horticulture Group. He's also the host of KNPR's Desert Bloom podcast. Norm, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
It's been a pretty unseasonably warm winter across much of the state. Southern Nevada didn't see a lot of hard freezes, if at all. What difference do you think that's going to make when it comes to our lawns and gardens this summer?
Well, the difference is already showing up. I don't know about this summer, but everything is pushing bud and bursting into bloom earlier this year. So we're starting fertilization earlier this year. Basically, the whole schedule's moved up. We had here in Southern Nevada the warmest December ever, and I think it's been the warmest winter ever. Maybe on the outskirts of the city, it got into freezing temperatures, but for the most part, not, and I don't know if that's ever happened. I'm not sure that it bodes well for the summer. And we'll see what the summer holds. You know, weather can be unpredictable and who knows what's going on, but things certainly have been shifting a lot climate-wise.
You know, it is still technically winter. Is it possible we might see a freeze?
It's always possible. And one of the scary things about that is if plants are pushing new growth and that growth can often be pretty tender, then that can get more easily damaged by a cold snap.
Well, you do need a good hard freeze to kill a lot of pests that infest lawns and gardens. What are some good ways of taking care of pests that might, you know, arise? Is it just depending on the pest itself?
Yeah, but I think there's some things you can do in general that can be helpful. First of all, you know, we have a tendency to want to really clean all the leaves up. The thing is that while those leaves can harbor some pests, they can also harbor predators. And that those leaves also are mulch. They're organic mulch. They're nature's mulch, and they help build soils. So one of the things about pests and disease and plants is that pests and disease will always be present. It's like in human health. You need to be healthy so your body can handle it. And what we want to do is we want to keep our plants in good health. And have good horticulture practices, maintenance practices, care practices that'll keep them in good health so they can handle whatever nature throws at them. and then monitoring the plant's health. One of the things I do share with people, you know, is that if you have a few leaves that are getting eaten, you know, that's just part of nature. Don't whip out the pesticides. And one of the big messages that I like to share with people is, you know, really hesitate to use pesticides except as a last resort. And the other thing I like to share with people is one of the things that really helps gardens is biological diversity, having different species. And what that does is that harbors different predators. And here's the big lesson in all of this. When you use pesticides, you're often damaging the predators just as much as you are the pests. But typically, pests have a more rapid reproductive cycle. So they come back quicker, and then the predators are no longer there to keep them in check. And often things are made worse through the use of pesticides rather than better.
Let's talk about our yards themselves, landscaping a bit. I know that the fall is really the best time to plant a tree, but is it okay to plant something this time of year?
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, they're going to have a chance still to develop root system. I'd still be willing to plant fruit trees. I think the trees that I'm the most interested in planting in the fall, especially, are those temperamental species, particularly the stone fruits, apricots, peaches, nectarines, plums, almonds, or apples and pears. Citrus, you know, they actually like a little bit warmer weather. Pomegranates, figs, you can plant now. And the thing is you can even plant into the spring, even on into the summer, as long as you keep the root ball moist. Because those plants would even be existing if they still in the nursery. You just got to water them often in the pot. Well, when you put them in the ground, now they have a chance to start putting their roots out. But at first, they're still right there. So you have to water more often. I think early February still plenty of time to plant for the coming season, especially desert plants.
On that note about biodiversity, you know, what are some trees that you'd like to see more of across the valley?
Oaks in particular. Oaks are long-lived. There's a lot of different species of oak really well here. There's some really cool desert trees as well. One of my favorites is called Texas ebony. And it's evergreen, beautiful, rich green color, and does really well here. Really dense canopy that birds love. Oh, the hackberries do really well here. And then, you know, I guess the other thing too is smaller trees. I often see large trees planted next to walls, next to driveways or walkways, where their root system are actually going to end up damaging it. Or in our yards, we have those narrow spaces next to our driveway. And it's just a little area between your driveway and the neighbor's property. And then, you know, two big trees, one for your neighbor, one for you, get planted there. They compete with each other. And then if they do well, they end up breaking the driveway. There's so many small species of trees that do really well here, like Texas olive or Texas mountain laurel, which is used quite often. There's a silver variety that's hard to find called Sierra Silver that's absolutely gorgeous and does even better. So smaller trees in smaller spaces is the key.
I just learned recently, and I guess it should have been obvious, but you can't actually plant a tree a little too deep, and it won't actually be able to breathe well enough. You know, what is the good rule of thumb if you're planting a tree?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because so when we're kids and when we're drawing trees, when you draw the trunk and it goes into the ground, you always have that trunk flare out, right? It just kind of just, you know, it's the beginning of the root system. And that's what you see in nature. We call it root flare. And a tree that's planted too deep looks like it's going into the ground and it has a totem pole. The thing is, they can also be planted too deep in the pot. So what you do is you just move it around. And if it's kind of wallowing around in the soil and that pivot point is down below soil level, it's probably planted too deep in the pot. So what happens then is that soil is held up against the trunk and it can introduce pathogens to the trunk tissue that, you know, the roots can handle moist conditions much better than trunk can, right? And so you can introduce pathogens and rot that way, but also soil on top of the root can suffocate them. So when you move it around in the pot, if you see it's kind of the pivot point is below soil, move that excess soil away. And you may find some young roots in there because the roots have moved up into that upper soil. Don't worry about it. Get rid of them. Plant it at the proper depth. And in fact, one of the things I was taught years ago was, you know, plant it high and proud. To put it up just a little bit up in the air, especially plants that like good drainage, or a little bit above ground level, raise it up an inch or two or three or four, depending on the size of the plant. The larger plants, maybe a little bit higher, little 1 gallons, maybe just a half inch or an inch. But that actually helps air get into the root system. You're avoiding that problem. The other thing, though, sometimes they're planted too shallow, and you may, when you look in the pot and you pull the plant out, you may see some of those roots exposed. The beginning of the root system, it's flaring out. Some of those roots are, so those you're actually going to put a little bit of soil on top of it. And the last thing I'll say is be careful with existing plants. Changing the soil up against or near in quantity near an existing tree can actually suffocate those roots and cause a lot of stress. Oaks in particular don't like the level of soil change very much at all. If you do need to do that, if you want to bring in some mounds, get some nice sandy soil, something that's going to drain well and let that air penetrate back in, and that'll help.
I'm talking to Norm Schilling, owner of Mojave Bloom Nursery and Schilling Horticulture Group in Las Vegas. He's also one of the hosts of KNPR's Desert Bloom podcasts. It's been an unusually warm winter across much of the state, and for much of Nevada, it feels like spring is right around the corner. Of course, it's still early February, and temps may return to normal over the next few weeks, but there's still a lot you can do now to get your garden and lawn ready for the summer months. Norm, what about lawn care for those of us who still have grass? You know, at what point should I be thinking about fertilizing?
Pretty quick here. I mean, I would look out. I think the first fertilization probably should, where we're at right now, should probably occur sometime in February. I don't think you need to do it quite yet. I don't think the nighttime temperatures and soil temperatures have reached the point where a lot of that nitrogen is going to be available. But probably by the end of the month, give it its first shot, and then follow that up about 6 weeks later.
Is it possible? You know, I've seen lawns in the desert. You know, is it possible to achieve one of those lush green lawns somewhere that gets to be 115 plus during the summer?
Absolutely, yes, and good luck. Because the thing is you are creating a very artificial planting. So nowhere in nature do you go out there. So you think about grassland. Grassland is actually, in nature, is a mixture of grass plants and broadleaf plants growing together in an ecosystem. What we try and do, or what happened in our society when lawns became the vogue thing back, you know, starting in the, I think, late 1800s and really catching on, you know, in the 1950s, I think, is when everybody was supposed to have their own lawn. You are doing a massive monoculture, one plant, no weeds. And that is not how nature operates, and she's always going to fight you. The heat is going to be stressful on the plant. You're going to have to use a lot of water. Now, the good news is there are other plant alternatives that create a lawn-like effect and function that use a lot less water and that can actually attract pollinators. I think the one that I'm the most interested in right now, really a fan of, is Carapia. Spells K-U-R-A-P-I-A. You can start it from plugs. You can get it in sod. It grows actively in warm weather. It seems to handle the heat real well. It'll fill in pretty quickly as long as it's in warm weather. In winter, it doesn't go dormant, but it doesn't grow. So it doesn't turn brown, but it won't actively grow. You don't have to mow it as much, so there's less maintenance and less pollution in that created in that maintenance. And it'll produce flowers, which, you know, help support pollinators, and it's very attractive. And the nice thing about it, too, is, you know, if you got dogs and a dog urinates, that concentration of nitrogen can kill a patch of grass. With fescue, traditional evergreen grass, that patch will stay dead. However, Carapia will fill back in. Another one is microclover. And microclover is a little bit taller. It's really cute. I don't think it's quite as functional because it, you know, it can get like 6-8 inches. But again, it'll fill in. And both of these supposedly use about half the water of a traditional lawn. So, and, you know, I got to tell you, man, I just beg people, don't plant artificial turf. Don't put that artificial turf down. It's full of microplastics. It breaks down into microplastics and nanoplastics, which are full of toxic chemicals, which you will end up ingesting. It is really, I look at it and I think, wow, that's just toxic waste that you put in your yard and pay good money for. In 8 years, you're going to have to rip it out and do it again and pay a lot of money again and again. It is a huge heat sink. So if you want a lawn, you know, maybe consider one of these alternatives, reduce the amount of area. And if you do have a lawn, consider this, plant fruit trees around that lawn. That lawn will then do double duty. It'll cool the area for the fruit trees. The fruit trees will put their roots into that lawn area, pick up that extra water, and you'll have more success.
I know there are a lot of folks who don't really care what's growing in their yard. They just want it to be nice and be low maintenance. What are some things that folks can do to maybe freshen up their yards that's really, you know, low cost or low effort?
Well, first of all, I'll share this. One of my favorite garden sayings is a good gardener should have a hard heart and a sharp axe. And while I love plants, sometimes the best thing you can do is take something out. I guess what I think of when I see a lot of these front yard landscapes, or, you know, sometimes in the backyard as well, there's this phenomena, I call it a shrub every 6 feet or a shrub every 8 feet. And it's just these bushes, one after another, and they all get turned into balls and boxes, and it's just really boring. What really brings in interest is when you have changes in texture, color, and form, and height. Sometimes there's a big plant right by your driveway or the sidewalk, and it's kind of in your face. You take that plant out, and you plant a small ground cover or a small perennial that might get 12, 18, 24 inches. Now it's no longer oppressive, and you brought in some height variability. I guess the other thing I really encourage people to think about is, you know, play with plants. Most of the time, you know, you're not going to regret it. You may have some failures. A little bit of research goes a long ways, and in my experience, sometimes I've been given bad advice at nurseries. So you might want to, you know, be careful about what you might be told, and do a little research yourself. I guess the other thing, though, is, you know, sometimes when death of plants is part of gardening, right? And so you put it in the ground, you hope for the best, and if it dies, you know, you understand and you move on and you try something else. But sometimes they just succeed, and sometimes it's far beyond what you hoped for. So, you know, there's some plants like mint that, you know, you want to put in a pot. I don't plant Mexican primrose because it's really invasive. But most plants, you know, you're safe planting. And if it works out, great. And if it doesn't, don't. But get out there. And I guess the other thing is bring in, if you're into it, if it's okay. Some people don't like succulents at all. But succulents in a garden can add so much texture and interest. And that form and texture and color of foliage is there year round. So vary it up, bring in some different species, get rid of the phenomena of a shrub every 6 foot on center, or every 8 foot. That's what I'd say.
Let me ask you this. You know, I have bought a number of succulents in my life, and the second I put them outside, they all seem to burn up and die. You know, what am I doing wrong?
You're putting the wrong succulents in the sun. So, you know, all those little cute succulents, like you go to one of the grocery stores and you see these cute little succulents in these little 2-inch containers, and they cost, you know, $2.99 or whatever. Those typically are going to be really happy in a pot, a little shallow pot, on a table under in shade outside. And then you let them go dry and then water, but give them shade. Now, when I say succulents, I'm including things like cactus and agaves and the different desert spoons and the bear grasses and things like that. They're succulents, or yuccas are a succulent. So ocotillos, those are all plants that love being out in the sun. So, but usually when people say succulents, you're talking about those little, really cute little guys like hens and chicks and pork and beans, and they're cute. But here's the thing, there's a high failure rate. But I look at it this way, it costs $2.99. So you get six or eight of them, you put them together in a pot, three of them do well, five of them croak. Okay, the three that do well start spreading. Maybe you get one or two more, fill in the empty spots, and you play with the pot. I've seen really nice succulent arrangements, especially in shallow pots, in shady areas on people's patios, just sitting on the table or over on a bench somewhere. And it brings such, it's such a joyful little planting, and they're just cute.
Norm Schilling is the owner of Desert Bloom Nursery and Schilling Horticulture Group in Las Vegas. He's also one of the hosts of KNPR's Desert Bloom podcast. Norm, thank you so much.
You can probably tell it really is my pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
She's the character that famously dies twice, but her story lives on in a play being staged in Las Vegas. Eurydice, which opens February 6th, centers the character for which the play is named. No longer in the narrative shadow of her more well-known husband, Orpheus, playwright Sarah Rule's 2003 version of the myth allows Eurydice to tell her own account of the underworld. It explores themes of death, memory, and the ties that bind. KNPR's Mike Privat spoke about the production with its co-director, Brion Genet, who's also the associate producing director of the theater company behind the production, A Public Fit. She's joined by Joe Kukin, producing director of A Public Fit. Here's that conversation.
Brion, Joe, welcome back.
Hey, Mike.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Hey, thanks for being here. Brion, let's start with you. What made you want to get involved with this play?
When I first read it, I was immediately taken in by the beauty of the language. And as I kept reading, I realized it was sort of an open canvas. And that really appealed to me because I think that gives a director permission to really kind of take a lot of risks and do something new and creative and just like wholly their own.
It sounds like when you were reading it, you started having ideas of your own.
Well, as I was reading it, I immediately thought of Nicole Unger and Adam Dunson, who play Eurydice and Orpheus, respectively. Adam Dunson is a musician. He's pretty prolific. And so obviously, as I'm like head casting the show, he and Nicole immediately came into my head. So that's where it really started, was just casting those two.
I don't want to forget your co-director, Jake Staley. What does he bring to the production?
Jake has been amazing. We have sort of co-directed secretly for a while. He's always been at the helm, and I've been kind of like present at rehearsals, and he always let me have a voice. This time around, this was a show that I chose, and it may have taken a little bit of convincing on my end to get him on board, but once he saw what we could do with the show and like sort of what my vision was for it, he was completely on board.
What is it about the mythology and the travails of Eurydice that makes for great theater?
Oh my gosh, Greek mythology is so compelling. I've always been interested in it since like high school. Just the characters and the like archetypes are so, I feel like they resonate with people like deeply on almost like a primordial level. And just Greek mythology has, it's like perpetually making a comeback. I've been playing the game Hades. I don't know if anyone's interested in that game. I love that game. The world, the underworld is so compelling to me. And just, yeah, it's been an interesting journey to sort of bring some of those ideas forward.
Now, I've seen some videos. This production, as we mentioned earlier, goes back to 2003. I've seen some videos. I've seen some artwork. And it looks like there's some unique production and visual elements to it. How is A Public Fit approaching some of the more visual aspects of the play?
Well, that's like such an exciting part of it, because most of the play takes place in the underworld. And Sarah Rule kind of gives the director permission to go a little bit crazy with the underworld. She alludes to it as being sort of like an Alice in Wonderland type of story, which appealed to me right away because, you know, I grew up watching Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz. Labyrinth is like my favorite movie. And I was like, we can create our own world with the underworld. And there really aren't a lot of hard and fast rules. And even if there are, we can bend them.
How does that accentuate the story? What's the benefit of having such a colorful and imaginative underworld for the sake of the narrative that you're using?
That's a really, really good question. I think that at the heart of this story, it's about grief, but it's about the beauty of grief. Because we can't really have grief unless we have love. You can only grieve something that you care for deeply. And so I think Sarah Rule decided to highlight the beauty of the grief. So we wanted to really bring forth the beauty of the text and the beauty of the world and the beauty of the actors.
Now, a big theme of this play, as I mentioned earlier, is memory. And I am seeing this, the topic, the theme of memory, pop up a lot when it comes to like lectures and books. Why do you think Sarah focused so much on this aspect of Eurydice's story?
It's a big part of the narrative because of like the Greek mythology just alone. There's the river Lethe, which is the river that washes away all your memories and your love and your sorrows. And that's a sort of tragedy in itself, but it's also kind of a blessing. If you're to spend a long time in the underworld, you're, you know, it's not a particularly fun place to be.
Right.
So I think that Sarah decided to focus on memory because so much of our grief is contained within our memories of another person. And when we recall those memories again and again, they shift and they change, and they change our perspective about that person, memories that we wish we had with that person.
Can I jump in here? Sarah was also going through personal tragedy during the writing of this play. And in a lot of ways, Eurydice is a tribute to her father who had recently died. And one of the things that she has talked about in interviews is the ongoing gift that she can give him by having him constantly be portrayed on stage again and again and again and again. With each new production, we see a new version of her father. We see a new retelling of her very personal story. And although, yes, the visuals are remarkable, and Brianna and Jake have done just a beautiful job of creating a world, a very dynamic, theatrically colorful, beautiful world, at the heart of this story is that sentiment and that sense of loss and that sense of deep, unending love for a paternal figure.
Do you think this story is an important one to tell where we are in the moment right now?
I do think that it's an important story to tell. I've been struggling with this question myself. It's a crazy time to be a human, and it's a hard time to be an artist because it feels a little silly to, you know, be focusing on creating art when the world is, you know, falling apart and, you know, people are being murdered in the streets and kidnapped. But I have to keep reminding myself and my fellow actors and, you know, creatives that it is important what we're doing because we are providing a place of joy and of comfort and of catharsis and escapism and deep reflection. And those things are all important. And it can't be 24/7 doom and gloom. There has to be moments where we can find connection with each other and joy.
Joe, this seems like a good time to bring you in here. I feel like a Public Fits programming, a lot of the plays, a lot of the productions that you do generally, to use the phrase, meet the moment. And in that respect, in your years of programming and shaping a Public Fit, I wonder how you saw Eurydice reflecting the current times.
This is our 12th season of operation as a theater company. Although we haven't always actively tried to, as you say, meet the moment, a compliment which I embrace fully, by the way. I think Eurydice, in dealing so beautifully and in some ways starkly with the reality of grief, is an acknowledgement that part of the growing pains of a country, of a community, grief is a huge part of that, and letting go of moments in the past that may not be beneficial to a community that's trying very hard to move forward, I think is important. And that coming together as a community, having those conversations, discussing the very real nature of our sorrows and our griefs, I think that's an important part of just creating a community. So I think Eurydice is a huge part of that.
I know that Eurydice hasn't even started yet, but you have a few more productions still in the hopper for the season.
We do. A Public Fit produces a 7-show season each year. We also offer another of Brianna's responsibilities is to curate and produce what we call The Outburst, which is an evening of storytelling. She puts together a fine coterie of, in this case, 6 storytellers. And I think your theme this time is star-crossed, am
I
right?
It is star-crossed. We're going with the Eurydice theme
of star-crossed, and that I think is February 18th in the Eurydice space.
Coming up. Joe Kukin is the producing director of A Public Fit, which will stage the play Eurydice Friday, February 6th through March 2nd. Brian Genet is the co-director for the play, and you can find out more details at knpr.org. Brian and Joe, thank you for coming.
Mike, thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR senior producer Mike Pravat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Paul.
Mike, I hear you've got butterflies on the brain.
Well, let me set this up. Do you, Paul, have an animal or an insect that you were petrified of as a young kid?
Yes, palmetto bugs, flying cockroaches still creep me out.
Oh, yeah, that's a good candidate. Mine was odd. Mine was butterflies. I don't know why snakes and spiders were fine, but butterflies had me running in the opposite direction. And I don't know, at some point, I was no longer afraid of them. But they are definitely also on the brain of photographer Jaime Rojo. You know, for more than 20 years, he has been documenting and watching the migration of these butterflies in the forests of Mexico. And along the way, he's captured the attention of wildlife conservationists, and his work got more and more attention. He started spending a lot of time on both sides of the border, and now he is a National Geographic Society explorer. And as part of the National Geographic Live Tour, he's going to share some of that research and observations and photography in this presentation slash show. And I guess this means there's a lot of photographs he'll be showing, but he's also going to be showing a lot of videos that he took in those Mexican forests. And this should make for a pretty neat show. That's tonight, February 4th, at the Smith Center at 7:30 p.m.
Sounds like a good way for families to experience the Smith Center. Now, you have more photography to recommend.
Yes. The Jaime Rojo event is a full-on show and presentation. I have an actual exhibit of photography to recommend. And it actually doubles as a history lesson.
Listen, I love history, so I can be easily persuaded.
Well, you are going to learn a lot about the importance of 1940 to Las Vegas and Nevada in this exhibit. What happened in 1940? 1940 for Nevada is a period of transition, especially as it pertains to tourism. So here's the history part. You know, here comes the New Deal. President Franklin Roosevelt establishes the Works Progress Administration. This gets people working during the Great Depression, and it also develops significant infrastructure across the country. And that includes Nevada, which at the time, as you probably well know, heavily relied on mining. That industry was shrinking, though. You know what industry was starting to grow?
Blackjack.
Pretty much. It was gaming. So Roosevelt declares a, quote, Travel America year for 1940. Now that all these roads have been built and all this public recreation infrastructure had been established, etc., and the WPA starts compiling and releasing state guidebooks to promote travel. And the book Nevada, A Guide to the Silver State was born. And a lot of the photographs that are in that book are taken by Arthur Rothstein. This is an acclaimed photographer who was previously known for his depictions of communities and towns in some state of flux or transition.
Cue photos of old casinos slowly panning across the screen.
Right. This exhibit shows what Las Vegas and other areas of Nevada looked like in 1940. So pictures of street fronts and neon signs and folks gathered around the blackjack table and what also looks like unoccupied mining towns. The Las Vegas outpost of the Nevada State Museum is not only showing Rothstein's beautiful photographs, but it also has artifacts from the time period. It also has Rothstein's cameras and hats and personal effects from that era when he was taking pictures in Nevada. So this isn't just a bunch of black and white photos on white walls. It's at the Nevada State Museum, and if you've ever been there, you know that its exhibits are designed to transport you back to the era that you are learning about. This exhibit is up until March 23rd, And the museum, for those of you who don't know, is at Springs Preserve.
I'm a Nevada history nerd, so definitely something I'm going to look forward to. You've got a visiting music act that'll provide a history lesson on film. What's going on there?
So have you ever seen a spaghetti western, like, say, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
You know, I've never actually understood who was supposed to be good in that movie, but yes.
To your point, I would say that the most famous aspect of that movie and others like it is their signature sound. And that was formed a long time ago by the late composer Ennio Morricone. He did all of Sergio Leone's films. Closer to home, he also was nominated for an Oscar for his work on the 1991 Vegas set film Bugsy. And I think he's done some like 400 plus scores for movies and TV. So his work is going to be celebrated and performed by the Montreal Guitar Trio, also known as the MG3. This act has played at UNLV a ton of times over the last 20 years. They specialize in classical guitar, and I think that makes them a natural to recreate Morricone's signature sound that was apparently formed in part from his experiments with folk music. So the trio themselves play many different types of music styles, from symphonic classical to progressive rock, which as acoustic music, I think that would sound kind of wild, and also the music of their Canadian homeland. They may in fact play some of that, but expect to mostly hear Morricone at UNLV. That show happens Friday, February 6th at UNLV's Judy Bailey Theater.
Mike, that is all the time we have for this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.